Listener Production.
Australia Today. Honest opinion, real talk.
Welcome to the Friday and last edition of Australia Today. Steve Price with you. It's the 16th of December. A full news update with Natasha Belling in a sec. Confusion reigns this morning around energy bills. If you listen to the critics, power bills will go up by $175 a year next year, not down. The government, armed with its new cap legislation, says, no, no, prices will go down. The Australian public deserves the truth here, deserves all the political spin to disappear. I think all Australians are sick and tired of this, and a fight between energy giants and Canberra isn't good for anybody. Keith Pitt, former resources minister in the Morrison government, will join us shortly. Everyone seems obsessed with the Prince Harry and Meghan Netflix second instalment from last night. I must say it sent me to sleep, but we will talk with Seven's Hugh Whitfeld in London shortly, and I'm sure Natasha Belling will have a surgical deep dive on it as well. We are live on the Listener app and regional Triple M network, and later this morning we will wrap up the news year for you. It's been a massive year of news, from floods to the passing of the Queen and Australia's great sporting moments. But on this Friday morning, let's get into it. Here's Natasha Belling with all the latest news.
Good morning, Steve. Happy Friday. Well, the royal family is refusing to make any official comment this morning after Prince Harry and Meghan dropped more bombshells last night in their tell-all documentary. The last three eps were released on Netflix overnight, with the couple lashing out at the media, also hitting out at Prince William and now King Charles III. Harry revealing he and Meghan had spoken with the royal family for a number of months about leaving before a very heated meeting with his brother, father and grandmother, the late Queen Elizabeth II.
It was terrifying to have my brother scream and shout at me and my father say things that just simply weren't true, and my grandmother, you know, quietly sit there and sort of take it all in.
The prince even claimed during the episodes he believed the legal battle with the tabloids all also caused Meghan's miscarriage. In other news this morning, locals in the close-knit community of Chinchilla will gather for a candle-lit vigil tonight to honour the two police officers killed in that tragic mass shooting in Queensland earlier this week. 26-year-old Matthew Arnold and 29-year-old Rachel McCrow died in the line of duty during the siege in Western Downs, along with an innocent neighbour. Lance Payne is the manager of a local aged care facility that runs Christmas fundraising events and has told Channel 7 they will now focus on supporting those who have lost so much during this week's tragic events.
Our residents annually do rumbles each Christmas, and after the tragic event on Monday, they asked if the donations from the rumbles could go towards the families. And from that, it sort of grew out, reached out to a lot of the local businesses, and we ended up with about 16 businesses donating items to host tonight's event.
A funeral service for the two officers will be held in Brisbane on Wednesday. 8 years on from Sydney's Lindt Cafe siege, and the officer that led the rescue team has broken his silence with damning allegations against the police operation. Officer A, whose name has been suppressed by the courts, believes his team could have saved hostages, Katrina Dawson and Tory Johnson, if they were allowed to storm the building earlier. He's told Channel 7 his team even considered breaking orders to enter the cafe.
From the moment that first gunshot gone, then yes, I do believe we would have changed the outcome. Not a moment, not a day goes by I don't think about the two of them.
Steve, that's an extraordinary story. Chris Reason, who did extraordinary coverage during the Lindt Cafe siege because the Channel 7 building was right opposite what was unfolding in Martin Place, they're pretty damning allegations.
Yeah, he stayed there, didn't he, Rizzo, with the cameraman?
Absolutely.
And yeah, that podcast is worth listening to. The News Limited papers ran some detail from the book that police officer has actually written.
Mm.
And I'm staggered it's 8 years ago.
I know, in that time. But I also do believe, you know, Katrina Dawson, who was one of the two victims, her family's a very well-connected legal family. I have no doubt in my mind, due to the tenacity of what Katrina's family pursued, that they were able to get to the bottom of what happened. And the fact that, as he mentioned during that interview with Chris Reason, that they had to stay outside and couldn't storm the building.
Yeah, it was. I remember watching it unfold live on television. I remember seeing the people from inside that escaped, and the horror on their faces as they came through those fire doors and got out of that place.
And also, I actually went to bed that night watching it incredibly late. I never thought I'd wake up and know that two people were dead, or three people.
Incredible. I'll get your views on the Harry Meghan thing in just one moment.
How long have you got?
Yeah, well, let's find out first from Hugh Whitfield what he made of it. Well, it is the big foreign news of the morning. The second part of the Harry and Meghan tale went to air on Netflix last night. I watched most of it. I've seen my good mate Hugh Whitfield on Seven on Sunrise this morning. That seems to be what everyone wants to talk about. Hugh, welcome. Lovely to catch up again. What'd you make of it, mate?
Morning, Steve. Well, I think it was definitely more explosive than the first three episodes. If there was any chance that Harry and Meghan may return to royal life, may spend any extensive time in the UK in the future, I think that is well and truly over. It does appear that Harry has taken a torch to the bridge between himself and his brother, that relationship, and he has burnt it down. The bridge is gone. The relationship is clearly over. For him to so publicly trash essentially his brother's character and accuse his father of being a liar is so incendiary. It's the stuff of the sort of headlines that Harry and Meghan have so valiantly crusaded against over the last couple of years.
Let's have a listen to that allegation he makes about his brother shouting at him. And Charles also being in the room, but more poignantly, the Queen sitting there quietly. Have a quick listen to this.
It was terrifying to have my brother scream and shout at me and my father say things that just simply weren't true, and my grandmother, you know, quietly sit there and sort of take it all in.
Taking us inside that room where the Queen witnessed this was quite an extraordinary thing to say.
Yeah, and I think there are certainly people here who see the fact that he has mentioned the Queen and spoken about that about her in that way as particularly inflammatory and incredibly disrespectful as well. A woman who, yes, served 70 years transforming the empire into the Commonwealth as we know it is today, and to just say that she sat back to preserve the institution. I mean, come on, mate. Like, why are you doing this? Now, if we asked that question and they did answer somehow, they would probably say that they want their truth put across. They want to tell their side of the story. But that's the thing here, Steve. This is a very one-sided story, a very one-sided 6 hours. The other people who appear are all supporting Harry and Meghan's perception of events and perception of the world. And you hear him talk about their being terrified of his brother. Well, speaking to people here, and I'm obviously not going to name names, well-connected people are saying that if you are terrified of that, mate, then, you know, that's quite a poor position to take. You're terrified of your brother screaming and shouting at you. Adam, did you get back up and scream and shout at him? We don't know because he didn't say.
Every family has its moments. I mean, you can almost put that to one side. Brothers fight all the time. Brothers don't, you know, get on forever. You split. There's families where brothers and sisters don't speak for years. So, yeah, we have to look at that in that context. But what about these allegations of racism from Meghan? Let's have a listen to what she said about death threats.
You are making people want to kill me. It's not just a tabloid. It's not just some story. You are making me scared.
How's the British public reacting to the racism comments?
Yeah, look, I think there's quite a few layers to this. I think much of the racism allegations were levelled in the first three episodes. The particular things here are the nature of the online trolling and the racism embedded within that was directed towards Meghan, particularly following the so-called Megxit, and the nature of the headlines within the media. Now, where Meghan gets emotional there, she's talking about the trolls who were writing that they wanted to kill her and that she didn't feel safe in their home. She just had Archie. She was concerned about the safety of her children. They are genuine concerns, and I'm not sure that anyone would be able to dispute those because they are clearly very dearly held, and we know that those death threats were being written on places like Twitter. There are additional allegations made that because of the press coverage and the press impact, that Harry says that that Meghan suffered a miscarriage in between the birth of Archie and Lilibet, and that was caused by the ongoing case that they had against the Mail on Sunday and the actions that the Mail on Sunday was taking to defend the case, the stress and the impact of that court case caused her to lose a child. That is awful. That is truly awful. for Harry to say that it was the Mail on Sunday that did that, that is also highly inflammatory and incendiary and potentially defamatory as well.
What are the British public making of this, Hugh? You've lived there for a long time now. I mean, we sit here in Australia, we sit down last night and we watch this, and there's great interest in our country about this. But Britain, England, where you live, is the seat of King Charles III and the royal family. What's the average Brit make of this? Do they just look at it and go, oh, well, that's two brothers fighting, or what are they saying?
Well, look, a couple of things, Steve. It's the top story, without a doubt. There's nurses strikes here, the posties are on strike, the trains are on strike. Harry and Meghan's the top story, whether you like it or not, because everyone knows the characters, everyone's talking about it. I've just been down at Westminster Abbey. Anyone who turns up to a royal event, you know, is a bit of a fan, right? You want to see them because it's something special, especially if you're a tourist. There were people there yelling out, and one woman said to me, is it okay to protest? And I was like, I said, I don't want to be a part of this. You do whatever you think you need to do. And I thought she's probably going to be protesting, surely in support of Harry. But no, she was yelling out, we love you, Kate. We love you, William. So protesting in support of the royal family, almost a rally in support of them. Look, I think there's definitely people here who don't care. There's definitely people who view this as rich people infighting. But the service of the Queen has been dearly held and dearly respected by this country. And I think Charles, for the most part, has got off to a flying start in his reign. He is being bogged down by these family issues that in the past have been kept behind closed doors, and I've got to say, for most families, generally are.
If the Queen was still alive, do you think they would have released this, or would they kept it?
Well, I think the most disrespectful comments towards the Queen were actually last week when Meghan appeared to mock curtsy the Queen when she did it for the first time. You add that into what Harry has said today about how she just sat back at Sandringham, and I actually think it's so disrespectful that they probably would have left it in. I actually think that they're so blind to how they're being perceived outside of the United States that they don't care anymore. And it's clear because they've gone so hard, particularly with these personal relationships. Why wouldn't they? They clearly just do not like the institution. They do not like how they believe they were treated, and they don't want to be a part of it.
I just wonder, though, you're sitting in Liverpool or Birmingham or Sheffield or somewhere, Worcester, you're watching this and you've got them complaining that the cottage they're in is not big enough, the roof's ceiling's too low. Oprah goes, oh, not a very big house you're in. I mean, that wouldn't go down all that well if you're struggling to pay your power bill.
Steve, it has not been above 0 degrees in London this week. There are people who are literally freezing within their homes. And you're right, if they're watching this, albeit having to pay for Netflix, so there's a barrier there anyway in order to listen to their truth, if they're watching this, they will be furious that this young man who was brought up in a literal palace is complaining about his brother screaming and shouting at him. I mean, where on earth has he been for the last 35, 40 years? It's unbelievable, really.
What happens next, Hugh?
The palace will keep calm and carry on. They are offering no comment whatsoever. I really do think that they hope this will blow over. But there is another storm on the horizon in the form of Harry's book, Spare, which is due for release on January 10. There is talk that he's in talks with big shot interviewers, particularly in the United States. Words being bandied around include Gail King from CBS, best friend of Oprah, that he might do a sit down with her in the run up to the release of that book. I mean, the journalist in me says these stories, these allegations need to be tested under the questioning of someone like a journalist who can say, well, mate, I'm not sure that this actually stacks up. Did that really happen? Gail King will probably not ask too hard of questions, although she did a really good job with R. Kelly a couple of years ago. The book is probably going to detail more allegations within, you know, the family and behind closed doors. It's not going to be pretty. And the problem with a book is that it just doesn't disappear like a TV show kind of does these days. book hangs around in libraries and in people's bookcases and it doesn't go away. And I think that could be a big problem.
Great stuff, Hugh, as usual. You know how much we treasure talking to you. It's our last show for the year. So everywhere from when you were in Kyiv, across the Ukraine, all of the big stories around Europe for the last couple of years, you've been very generous with your time. We really enjoy watching you on 7 on Sunrise on the news and talking to you on the radio. So thank you very much, my friend.
Thanks, Steve. It's been a really big year over here, so thanks for having me on.
Hugh Whitfeld from 7. Only person who knows more about Harry and Meghan than Hugh is Natasha Belling. What do you make of it?
International Royal Correspondent. Yep. How good is Hugh?
Very good.
He's excellent. Outstanding.
Number one.
Look, the feeling I had watching that is I was incredibly sad. I think the takeaway from it is Prince Harry has burnt all of his bridges to the royal family. There's no coming back from here. He absolutely targeted his brother. There is awful damage to their relationship. I'd say it's irreversible. And also he had a red hot go at his dad, Prince Charles, the now King Charles. They alleged during the documentary it all fell apart after their visit to Australia. So there is an Australian angle. When they came here for their tour, they were superstars.
Everyone, I don't even remember the tour.
No, I do, because they were actually why I...
Where'd they go?
Thought it was fantastic. The Opera House. They went to Bondi Beach to raise the profile of mental
maybe
health group.
Were they only in New South Wales?
Well, they definitely went to Dubbo. And why I loved that is because the international focus and the national focus was on the devastation of the drought.
Yep.
And I thought they were fantastic doing that, because that was a really important issue that wasn't getting national attention here about the devastating drought. So it all fell apart because that they allege that there was more focus on the popularity of Meghan and Prince Harry than, wait for this, than Kate and Wills.
So that's history repeating itself, because the often mentioned 83 tour here, where as we walk down the main street of Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane or wherever we were, if you're on the Charles side of the street, you're annoyed that you weren't on the Diana side of the street. So
very
that's
sad.
Exactly what happened.
And he says that. He said, this is exactly what happened to my parents, and correct. That caused a lot of problems in their marriage. Now, of course, he also made serious allegations against leaking of very damaging stories, not from within her own family, Meghan's, but within his own royal family.
That's been happening forever.
From the offices of his own brother and his own father. Don't give me facts, Steve. Anyway, this is what he was alleging Prince William had done to Prince Harry and his new wife, Meghan.
That day, a story that came out saying that part of the reason why Meghan and I were leaving was because William had bullied us out. And once I got in the car after the meeting, I was told about a joint statement that had been put out in my name and my brother's name, squashing the story about him bullying us out of the family. I couldn't believe it. No one had asked me permission to put my name to a statement like that. And I rang Em and I told her, and she burst into floods of tears, because within 4 hours they were happy to lie to protect my brother. And yet for 3 years, they were never willing to tell the truth to protect us.
Woe is me. God, he's a whinger.
I felt very sad, and I felt incredibly sad.
All families have breakdowns at some point with brothers not talking to one another. I mean, they're high profile, obviously, because they're royal.
Mm.
But there's been plenty of people listening to us right now who haven't spoken to their brother or sister for years because of family upsets.
But also it's interesting he did say.
So he's got to go back to his $80 million mansion in LA and sit by the pool and feel sorry for himself.
Which is an excellent point, Steve, because right now we know cost of living crisis in the UK is horrific. People can't afford to turn on.
Sell a book.
Hang on. So this is also what Meghan was alleging and Prince Harry, that personal and mental toll, the barrage of media scrutiny took on them. Prince Harry alleges it was instrumental in the couple losing a baby. Take a listen.
I believe my wife suffered a miscarriage because of what the Mail did. I watched the whole thing. Now, do we absolutely know that the miscarriage was caused by that? Of course we don't. But bearing in mind the stress that that caused, the lack of sleep, and the timing of the pregnancy, how many weeks in she was, I can say from what I saw, that miscarriage was created by what they were trying to do to her.
Yeah, we feel very sorry for that, if that's what in fact happened. Awful things. But as Hugh Whitfeld just told us, it hasn't gone above 0 degrees in London this week. There's people in the UK can't afford to heat their house.
Or turn a toaster on.
They've got Oprah complaining about the size of their cottage.
Okay, I'm going to ask you, as a journalist of 50 years' experience running newspapers, all of your bits and pieces you've done over your great career.
Yes.
What would you advise the royal family to do? Because today they've come out saying they're not going to make any official comment. I'm talking about King Charles and Prince William. And Prince William and Catherine, the two children, have appeared at Westminster with Christmas celebrations. And the official word is no comment. Would you say that they should comment?
No, they've done exactly what they needed to do. Every member of the working royal families turned out to that event with the Christmas carols of the trees, the snow, the kids, all dressed impeccably. They'll go off to the where they normally go, Balmoral, for Christmas, and they'll move on. The royal family will survive and Prince Harry and Meghan will finally just fade away.
We recorded special episodes.
It depends. I mean, if you're in the United States, it's different.
Yeah, but we recorded special episodes of Morning Agenda and we spoke to a psychic, because I know you believe psychics. And she said, wait, Prince Harry will be a new world leader more powerful than his father. Watch this space.
What does that mean?
I don't know. She just
a new world leader.
Could he possibly be a new? Would you rule him out running for US president?
Can't, because he's not born in the US.
Don't give me facts, Dave.
You can't run for president if you're not an American.
That's what the
Sorry
psychic
to knock
me.
Your psychic story sideways. What's the politics of what's going on here with energy? Peter Van Onselen is Network 10's political editor. Joins us on the line. So, are our power bills going up or down?
Oh, they're definitely going up, but the argument attached to this deal in the short term, at least, and when I say short term, I mean about halfway through next year, it won't be before then, they will be slightly less than they would have otherwise gone up by, would be the way to put it. So Treasury has apparently modelled that it'll be $230 less in the long run, you know, by the middle of next year than it otherwise might have been. Labor promised at the election, as you well know, to bring power prices down by $275. This doesn't bring them down by $230 if Treasury's right.
It's a con job.
Beg your pardon?
It's a con job. We were told they'll come down by $275. You're saying they'll go up, but not up as much, so they won't go up $230 less than what they otherwise would have.
So think of it this way. If they, this is random, but if they were going to go up for a particular household by $730, they will now go up by $500 rather than $730. That's essentially what Treasury is telling us.
So what does it do economically when these big energy companies suddenly say, okay, we're jack of all of this stuff. We're going to halt exploration. We're not going to search for as much gas as we would have otherwise. The states then start getting hit with lower royalties to their state budgets. How long does this peace agreement between New South Wales, Queensland and Canberra last for?
Well, potentially not very long at all, including with possible changes of government as well as changes of electoral circumstances in each state, depending on what does happen with those power prices and with, as you mentioned, with royalties as well. It's a serious point. The exploration and the willingness of big companies to invest is now at risk. But you know the irony, Pricey? It's not just mining companies. This could actually bring investment in renewables into question, which, of course, they regard as the nirvana of future capacity to provide generation of power. And the reason for that is this. They've now shown a willingness to put a price cap in place. They've done it for gas and coal over a 12-month period. But it's the willingness to put a price cap in that means that, for example, if there are severe weather events that cause disruptions in the longer term when it comes to, you know, renewable power that has been stored when batteries have the capacity to do it. If that happens, we now know that that will create price spikes, and we know that this government would be prepared to put a price cap on that to try to help consumers out. What does that mean? That means if you're looking to invest in renewables in this country, you have to think, well, hang on, this is the land, the sunburnt land that has all these sorts of different weather events. If that ever creates a spike in power prices, then lo and behold, they are going to be willing to put a price cap on. That will reduce investment in renewables, which is the very thing that they say is the saviour, if you like, in the longer term.
Would Labor be saying to itself internally, look, we're right at the beginning of our term in office. We're probably going to have two terms in government. Let's get all this messy stuff done now and people will forget about it by the time we get to the next election. Where's that leave Peter Dutton?
Well, Peter Dutton, I think, is playing the medium for long-term game. It's interesting because Anthony Albanese, when I interviewed him for the book that I did on his win at the last election, he and his team made the point that they were all about trying to kick with the wind in the fourth quarter, even though he's a Rabbitohs supporter. He used the AFL analogy. We don't care where we're at in the electoral cycle. We want to be kicking with the wind in the fourth quarter, i.e. doing well when the election comes around. Now, to his credit, he did do that and he won the election. Peter Dutton may well be the one kicking with the wind in the fourth quarter, as long as he can survive until then, because in the medium to long term, power prices are going to keep going up. This is a short-term fix at best, and as we've talked about, it could result in a reduction in investment in renewables, it could result in a reduction in investment in mining exploration, and it could present a sovereign risk as well. Now, they felt that they had to do something, having done nothing in the budget. Don't forget that. Power prices were going to surge by over 50%, and there was nothing in their October budget to counter that. There was a backlash to that, and they tried to cobble together a deal ahead of Christmas because that's what they promised. The politics in the short term is good. They got it done. In the medium to long term, I'm not so sure.
I'll get Keith Pitsby on this in a moment. So that's it for the political year. All done and dusted?
That's it. Yep. So not until February next year when Parliament returns, which is, by the way, when they could have looked at this legislation because it doesn't actually take effect until the halfway mark of next year.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for helping Australia Today out over the next last 18 months, Peter, PBO. It's been a great pleasure. I look forward to catching up with you personally and see you on Network 10.
Keen for all of that and really appreciate you having me, Price. It's been an absolute pleasure on my end to work with you as well.
Good on you. Peter Van Onselen from Network 10.
And let's check the weather details around the country for this Friday as we head into the weekend. Orange, partly cloudy, top of 18. Partly cloudy conditions also for Bathurst and Mudgee. No rain for Dubbo, top of 25. 20 and partly cloudy for Canberra. No rain for Wagga, top of 23 today. 24 and sunny conditions expected for Griffith. Shower or two on the way for Coffs Harbour, 22 degrees. Shower or two also for Port Macquarie, low of 12 and top of 21. 19 degrees and cloudy for Mount Gambier. And a shower or two on the way for Hervey Bay and a top of 28.
Well, lots of showers all around the place. Did you know, did you hear the story about the spinach from Costco?
I did.
People have been advised not to eat Riviera Farm branded spinach with an expiry date of December 16th. So that's today.
Today.
Well, how are you with use-by dates? Do you normally fling stuff if it's on the date?
I'm controversial. It's a guide.
A guide.
And fresh fruit and vegetables maybe. But look, I've been able to use spices in the cupboard that are 10 years old.
So a whole bunch of people had to seek medical attention. But the interesting thing is, the Poisons Information Centre Director, Dr. Darren Roberts, said people can have confusion, hallucinations, dilated pupils, rapid heartbeat, flushed face, blurred vision, dry mouth, skin and fever. He said no one's died, so we're very happy about that. Good. And we hope it remains that way, but these people are very sick. So it's contaminated spinach giving people hallucinations.
Sounds like my conditions when I work with you.
Go, if you're going to Costco, perhaps give the baby spinach.
What's caused it?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's not spinach. That's the only thing I can think of. Another plant-based product, perhaps.
It's been a crazy year, hasn't it, Steve Price? And that just tops it. Spinach giving you hallucinations.
Yeah, I love spinach too.
Do you? Of course you do.
I do.
You voted for the Greens, didn't you, once?
Thanks for reminding me about that. The Australian public are absolutely confused about what happened in Canberra yesterday. One thing we do know, it cost $1 million to get everyone to go back there, the politicians I'm talking about. And we had the energy legislation passed. But does it mean you're going to get cheaper power bills? Well, no one seems to be able to tell me that. One man who might be able to provide some answers, hopefully, is the former Minister for Resources and Water, the MP for Hinkler, Keith Pitt. Good to talk to you again.
Hi, great with you. Great with the listeners.
Will my power bill that I get next year, I just paid my electricity and gas bill today, so I'll get one again in a couple of months, will it be cheaper?
No, it'll keep going up. And that's what Labor's own modelling and their own budget says. Your gas bill and your power bill are going up under federal Labor.
So, you know, I read today that we've got a cap on gas prices, we've got a cap on the price of coal. The federal government is saying, and they're using Treasury modelling, that has not been made public, by the way, they estimate next year's gas price will increase by 4%. That's the wholesale price. And that electricity price rises will be held back at 23% in 2023. But that doesn't necessarily mean your retail price goes down.
Well, not only that, it sounds like it's going up most definitely. What they've done, and it's, to be honest, it's just a dog's breakfast. It's an absolute shambles. It basically only applies to the Gladstone exporters for gas. They've excluded the market in Victoria, in Brisbane, in Sydney. It only applies to Wallumbilla and Moomba. And you can't get the gas from Gladstone to Victoria anyway. So what we see now is the Australian taxpayer is propping up the very poor decisions of the Victorian Labor government to not explore and develop their own gas assets. all someone else's fault. And it's even worse in Queensland, where they'll be propping up Anastasia Palaszczuk's daylight robbery in the electricity network, where the state government owns most of it. But they're profiteering to the tune of some $5 billion.
Santos bosses likened it to something out of Soviet Russia. Would you agree?
Absolutely. He didn't miss. And I think one of the things, and I know this is not of a direct impact, direct interest to most Australians, but out in the world where you're trying to attract tens of billions of dollars investment on projects that have very long lead and development times, the federal Labor government has destroyed this country's reputation overnight. It took a handful of minutes for them to say that, hey, thanks for the 60-odd billion or whatever it is that you've invested in gas in this country. We're changing the rules and we don't care about the fact that you've got to pay back finance and meet the requirements of the ASX and ASIC and whatever else might be around, including your shareholders. We're going to do this regardless of what damage it does. How do we get people to invest in the resources sector to develop things that this country needs? Because they're high risk. Exploration's hard. You don't always have a win. Sometimes you have a miss, and that costs money.
What would you be doing?
I would have done exactly what we were doing inside the coalition, and that is develop our gas, our own gas assets, particularly in the Beetaloo, more in Bass Strait, and of course, try everything we can to get Victoria to develop their own, because that's where the demand is, that's where the shortfall is. In fact, Federal Labor's own consultation document says they didn't include the Victorian market because they thought it might result in shortages of supply, which means no gas, it'll mean blackouts and real problems in industry. And I think the real test for this and for Anthony Albanese in the Labor government will be every time your power bill comes in and your gas bill comes in, did it go down? And if the answer is no, well, you know who to blame.
When you're not in Canberra, you move around in the real world. I think real Australians are sick and tired of the political spin they're getting here. They had an election, Labor won, okay, that's the people's decision, but they were told that they would get $175, was it $175 or $275?
$275, yep.
$275 drop in their electricity bill. That never happened. So Labor's decided to come up with this idea to try, it seems to me, to convince people who don't listen as hard to what's going on as you and I do, Keith, that, oh, yeah, they delivered on their promise. But it's not real.
No, it's completely false. And it's funded by the Australian taxpayer. And it's for a one-off bill at some point in the future. We still don't know where or when. It won't apply to all Australians. It'll only apply to some in some states. So you'll have a different rate in a different state for Labor's mates. And you just don't know what you'll get, but you can be absolutely guaranteed your bill will keep going up. I mean, you look at what happens in Europe. Germany is subsidising their power and gas bills by 200 billion euros. I don't want to see our country in that position. So the best thing we can do is get more supply into the market and make sure you've got industry on side and continue to develop. As I said, these are long lead time projects. They could take 10 years. And we know in places like Narrabri in New South Wales, for example, they've been messing about there for a decade, and that is all going to the domestic market. And they're now trying to say to the big exporters in Queensland, too bad, so sad. That was 10 years ago you put your money in, and we know you've got some contracts, but it's all your fault that Victoria is running out of gas and we've got shortfalls. It is Labor's policy. It'll be Labor's fault. And when you get blackouts, well, you can blame Mr. Bowen.
And it's all coming out of the bottom line. Taxpayers are paying. You've got this $1.5 billion Keith power bill subsidy for lower income households, but we don't know exactly what lower income households. What's lower income? Where does that kick in, not kick in?
Well, this is the other point. It's to be delivered apparently through the states and the retailers. Well, how would the retailers know? Are you going to ring up and say that your income's below a certain threshold? I just don't see how this will work. And not only that, they'll clip the ticket, because they've got to administer all of these things for the delivery of the payment. I mean, if Mr. Albanese wants to do this, we'll send a check. I mean, that's what Labor's always done in the past. But they're trying to walk both sides of the street here and say, oh, no, it's not inflationary and it's not a subsidy. But some people will get a chocolate, others won't. It certainly won't be business, and that'll have an impact on jobs.
Got pink bats written all over it again. Just I mentioned yesterday the deal that the Greens have done to give the tick to this legislation. And what they've got the Albanese government to agree to is that households will convert from gas to electricity. So I looked at the practicality of that. I mean, how many people have instant gas hot water systems? I do, and most of the people I know do. Who's going to pay for me to convert to electricity? The government again?
No, it'll be you. I'm an electrician by trade, so I've got a reasonable idea of what has to be done to make this actually happen.
Can it work?
No. No, I mean, the idea that you'll go and retrofit every house in Australia and turn them from, you know, gas to electric and then not have to upgrade your wiring, your mains, potentially your switchboard, potentially all of the supply outside in your subdivision, it's just fraught with danger. But this is what happens under a Green Labor government. You know, I raised this in Question Time last year, this exact issue, because it's Labor's Environmental Action Network. That's their policy, to get rid of gas appliances and gas barbecues and everything else. And I was pulled up by Mr. Burke, the member for Watson, and he said this was a wild fantasy and I'm effectively misleading the House. Well, guess what? The wild fantasy's come true. It's Labor's policy and they're delivering it.
Most people don't want to not cook with gas. Have you tried cooking a stir fry on an electric stove?
My wife actually rang me yesterday and said, I'm not giving up my gas stove. I said, mate, well, it's not happening yet. But, you know, the idea that this is the most important thing in this country at this time that they need to focus on, I think is wrong. I don't think they really understand what it costs for every individual if you were to go and change all of your gas appliances and then have to try and retrofit them into your existing house. I just think this is one of these crazy ideas of the Greens. But unfortunately, that's the Green Labor government. That's the deal they had to do to get their energy legislation through, and there'll still be one where the prices continue to go up.
Well, at least you don't have to go back to Canberra again until next year. Keith, thanks for your help, and thanks for your help this year. Good on you.
Yeah, well, we're not sure about that yet. I thought we were done a week ago. But, yeah, thanks so much, Stephen. Have a great Christmas.
You too. Keith Pitt, the former Minister for Resources and the MP for Heathcliff. Someone who's helped us out a lot over the last 18 months is Scott Phillips, the Chief Investment Officer for Motley Fool, joined us on the line for the last time, mate. How would you assess the economy right now in Australia?
Oh, Steve, mate, thank you for a great 18 months so far too, mate. Look, it's been a really rocky ride, and I think we're kind of on a bit of a precipice. And I don't mean we're necessarily going to go over it, but we have really, really strong economic growth, very strong employment. The government's, frankly, tax receipts are in a really good position, at least relative to where they've been and where they could have been. Those are all really positive. On the other side, we know inflation is way too high. Interest rates are going up and putting a whole lot of stress and pressure on a whole lot of households. Now, it's a subset of households. Inflation hits all, of course, but rates only hit those, a third of us or so, who are paying a mortgage. So you've kind of got this really difficult situation of how long do rates need to be this high? How long can households afford to pay continuously higher prices and, frankly, what are going to be higher rates coming? So I think we're on a bit of a knife edge. I'm not convinced we're going to go over the other side, but we are in a very, very precarious position, perched very carefully. It's going to require some very, very careful management and a lot of luck next year.
It's very hard to explain it, isn't it? Because you look at those jobless numbers yesterday, you got full-time employment accounting for more than half a total increase, 34,200 new full-time jobs. So,
mate, so good.
If you want a job, you can get a job, right?
Pretty much. As long as you've got the appropriate skills, you're in the appropriate location. That's why there's always some unemployment. But at the same time, as you say, really low unemployment, bosses screaming out for workers in certain industries and certain locations. That's part of the inflation problem, quite honestly, that at the moment we've got this, call it capacity constraints. There is more demand in the economy than we have the capacity to fulfill. That's wages, it's employees, it's products. You know, we know the cost of oil and other things are continuing. Energy, same thing. So that's the problem. When an economy arguably overheats, I think we're probably in an overheat stage, that's exactly the issue. We took, and the RBA and the government, past and present, need to be accountable for letting it overheat to this point. But now they're desperately, you know, got the fire extinguishers out trying to keep things under control. So we have a really hot economy. That's the reality of it. Even though inflation is up and people say, well, I'm doing it tough, that's absolutely true. But the economy itself continues to grow strongly. Unemployment is very strong. We are at capacity. We literally, that's why prices go up. When supply is constrained and demand keeps growing, that's why you get higher prices. It's economics 101. So that's exactly where we're at. And it's why you can have at the same time high rates, high inflation, but full employment effectively and strong GDP and output growth.
Global economy gets battered around by what happens, obviously, with the Ukraine invasion by Russia. But why does that have such a big effect on the global economy? Why is it? I mean, it's two, you know, countries in the middle of Europe. Yeah, okay, Russia's a big energy exporter. Is that the reason?
Largely, mate, yeah. Combination of two things. So, and this is, I'm a bit dirty on half of it, but the real answer, the real world answer is that Russia exports a truckload of gas to Europe, in particular, and We saw, you know, during the worst of COVID, the oil price went negative. These things are so finely balanced. If you've got a little bit more oil than you have demand for, prices go negative real fast because there's nowhere to put it. On the other hand, when you've got a little bit more demand than you've got supply, everybody wants oil so they can do their thing. So I want oil, but you want oil. There's only one lot to go around. We just outbid each other on price. And so it's a really, really fine-tuned machine, which works beautifully most of the time. When it falls over, like when it goes negative during COVID, or when it's positive and hugely high like it is now, that's what happens. In the non-real economy, I have a decent amount of scorn reserved for financial traders who, frankly, the price of oil now we're paying is not because it costs that to get it out of the ground. It's because 3 and 6 months ago, some traders bet on the price, oil futures, and they said, well, I think it's going to be expensive by then. So they put in some forward contracts. I'm not going to explain the detail. It's not, no one cares enough. But basically, by doing that, it sets the actual delivered price now. So 6 months ago, they bet on what it might be. That's what impacts the price now. It's not quite that simple, but it's not much more complex either. And so you've got a bit of a real-world economy issue, and then you've got the desk jockeys who are you know, trading back and forth, trying to make a few bucks, guessing on where the price might be, and that's a very significant impact as well.
So anyone with a super fund is going to stare down the barrel next year of, again, pretty much neutral or negative results on their investments.
So I don't know that's necessarily true, mate. It might be. It absolutely might be. But don't forget, the markets tend to move ahead of these things. We've seen, I mean, the NASDAQ is off a third over the last, this US tech market, a third over the last year. The market generally does front run these problems. A bit like COVID, we saw the market crash in March and April of 2020, and then actually bounce back most of the way, even before Delta hit, let alone Omicron, and then the 2.5 years that came after that.
Well, I hope you're right, because a lot of people listening to us want to get more investments. As
no,
I said, mate, thank you very much for your help for the last 18 months. It's been sensational. Your advice is solid gold, and we've been really privileged to have you on the program. So thanks a lot, Scott. Good on you, mate.
You're very kind. It's been a joy, Steve.
Scott Phillips there from Motley Fool.
Australia Today's weekly wrap.
Our last Australia Today program of the year, and what a year of news, of natural disasters, political change with a new Labor government. Of course, a year when we lost Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, and the people of Ukraine, of course, have suffered a year of invasion from the Russians. And that's a conflict that changed the global economic outlook with an energy crisis. And sadly, this week, the year ended with the senseless death of two young Queensland police officers brutally executed in a shooting that took six lives. For us, it's been a pleasure to cover these world-changing events on the Listener app and the Triple M Regional Network. This will also be the last Australia Today program for us. That is a sad moment as well. We have so much enjoyed talking in particular to regional Australia, especially as we are about to hear about those devastating floods that swept through Brisbane and the Northern Rivers, Wide Bay, Western Downs, and then, of course, Western and Southwest Sydney, to the greater west of New South Wales, Forbes and Molong and Yugowra, and further south still to the Victorian river towns of Rochester and Echuca. Programs like this, I think, importantly talk to the locals. Other mainstream capital city media often don't get to. So to my great colleague, Natasha Belling, whose calm, professional and caring support, thank you. And to Tara Maloney, the super producer, for all the content that kept the wheels turning. And to Simon and Helen before that, Matt, thank you very much. Let's get into our year in review. Natasha Belling, this is going to be interesting going back through this.
Can I just take this opportunity, Steve, to say what an absolute honour and joy it has been to work with you. Not only are you an extraordinary journalist and broadcaster, but you're very, very kind and giving, and you have a wonderful sense of humour, and what an absolute pleasure and honour it's been to work with you. And to do what I love is giving a voice to regional people, because as you mentioned earlier, often they don't get a platform or a voice, and we've been very passionate on Australia Today about doing that.
We have, and you haven't had to see me face to face. That's been the other advantage of working with me for the last 18 months. You've been able to do it remotely because of COVID and Zoom.
What a roller coaster it's been.
I haven't mentioned here COVID.
I know.
So how will we forget something like that? You and I lived through all of 2022 and 2021 with COVID.
With a pandemic. Lockdowns. And homeschooling, which still triggers me.
And police chasing me because I dared walk out the house without a mask on.
Can you talk about
handcuffing
that?
Handcuffing me and telling me to go
home. Playgrounds again. Locked up playgrounds. It's been an extraordinary roller coaster. Oh. When you look at what we've experienced, and we've been very lucky, Steve, we've had jobs and we haven't lost loved ones. Mm. It's been a roller coaster ride.
This year in particular has been extraordinary.
Mm.
Not to mention Harry and Meghan. I mean, really, you know.
This is someone
the highlight
who
of your
refused
year.
To watch the series, but then had a complete analysis of it because you were forced to watch it, correct?
Correct. I think we do need to put into context the flood situation because, I mean, it was extraordinary where they hit and when they hit. And your mind just, you know, forgets these things. So we started 2022 and we were on air from mid-January. By the time we got to the end of February, the Northern Rivers area and Brisbane were just smashed. So in Brisbane, 28 February, the Brisbane River height reached 3.8 metres. And then you had, of course, what happened in Lismore. Now, who could ever forget that? The Wilson River reached 14.4 metres in that town. That surpassed all other flood records by more than 2 metres. Swept through that whole community. Multiple deaths, as we know, destruction, billions of dollars worth of damage. And I was talking to Steve Krieg the other day. They've still not recovered from
and
that.
Steve, that was unfolding when we were actually on air. I really clearly remember that moment where we were starting to see pictures come through on television and we were thinking, oh my gosh, what is going on in Lismore? And then remember we were on air and the only way all of these people could communicate was often through Facebook saying, you know, my loved one or my friends on the roof of their house, they can't get out. And of course, we all know what an absolute disaster was unfolding and that locals were stopped from getting in their own boats to go and rescue people that were trapped in their own homes.
On that day, one of the first people we spoke to was Lismore councillor Ellie Bird. Here's how that unfolded. Ellie, how are you coping there?
All right, considering, thanks.
The levee bank itself, has that been breached?
Well and truly, the levee bank went over probably around about 2:30 a.m. this morning. And what we are currently seeing is unprecedented flooding in Lismore. So we're currently approaching a height of around 14 metres, which is higher than the highest flood on record. And it's looking likely to go even higher.
Natasha's been looking at the Lismore Facebook page. A lot of reports there about people being unable even to access rescue, including people trapped on rooftops. Is that happening, Ellie? Do you know?
Yes, that's correct. So we're seeing a situation where people who have never had water inside their houses before are being flooded. People have been absolutely caught out and are stuck in their houses. So lots of people are making their way onto roofs to attempt to wait for rescue. But we're also seeing that the SES rescue line and the 000 lines are overwhelmed. So people are having trouble getting through to log requests for assistance. So yes, currently there are a lot of people sheltering on their rooftops waiting for rescue crews to get to them.
So it was still unfolding. We were talking, you were checking on Facebook. Mm. And of course what happened, the SES could not cope with it because they had two boats, hadn't been funded properly by the various governments. So what happened? The local communities took to tinnies, jet skis and started rescuing people themselves.
And we heard of terrifying stories of elderly women and elderly men, families and their young children trapped in the cavity of their roofs waiting for people. And then people were saying with mobile phones when they were running out of batteries, just record a message before it drops out saying where you are. I'm on this street in Lismore. Come and get me. And then during the program on Australia Today, we also spoke with Federal Nationals MP for Page, Kevin Hogan, who's been extraordinary in making sure the voices of his local residents are heard. Let's take a listen to what he said.
They are being overwhelmed, Steve. This prediction for the flood last night was at 12 metres or around 10 or 11 metres. And overnight with heavier rain, the river peak is now going to be 2 metres higher at 14 metres. So this is unprecedented. We have people who are in houses who have normally never been flood affected in the history of the region. So they are now surrounded by flood water and now have to be picked up in boats to make sure that they literally don't drown in their houses. So this is a severe situation. Everything is mobilised. I had ADF approval to come in support the region a few hours ago. Everyone from the Prime Minister down is aware of the gravity of the situation here. The situation is, though, because the weather event is still current, so this, you know, even at my place, the rain is still very heavy, the weather is still very volatile, that it is causing logistical issues to get some of that support in. But everything's mobilised, everything has been signed off and everything is supported to get every resource here that we need. But it's a very grave situation right now. From the very earliest hours of this morning, literally I've been on the phone to every emergency services minister, state and federal, the Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, the Prime Minister, the Premier, the Deputy Premier and the Deputy Prime Minister. They are all aware. I've made very clear a number of hours ago that this is a life and death situation, and everything needs to get mobilised, and it is being. That being said, there are literally weather logistical issues to get some of that support here. Obviously, roads and highways are cut. People can't get through. And even with aircraft, it is proving challenging given the current weather event is still here.
Kevin did an extraordinary job. And one of the things that we discovered when we were talking to him on that morning, it might have been 2 days later, I think, when we got to March, that the Bureau was predicting that the river would peak at somewhere around 11.5. And everyone started to say, OK, if it's 11.5, we might be OK. Well, it went to 14.5.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Bureau has to look at its modelling. They got that completely wrong. Steve Krieg, we'll hear from him in a moment. He's still living it. We talked to him as recently as this week. But you remember one of the amazing rescue stories was Janelle Saffin. Now, she's the Labor MP for Lismore. Her husband actually was clinging to a tree for hours before he got rescued. But we managed to talk to Janelle. Janelle is tiny.
Yes.
Janelle's shorter than you. She's a very frail young woman, older woman, and she almost drowned.
Mm.
And she was so lucky. Here's how she told us she survived.
My only thought was, as the waters, and there were three of us, three women, you know, all similar age, because I stay in town when it floods. The roads cut off. So I stay in town in a house where it never floods. But as the water was rising and we're sort of hanging off the rafters on the veranda, it was like, okay, it's time. Time, girls, let's go. So into the water, and we swum up the road, so to speak, and we said stick close to houses, you know, that we knew, like the water was sort of coming up to the roof. Our thought was we've got to swim. Look, I knew it was a bit scary and we had to pass one channel. We managed to secure a tyre from under a tree, a full tyre, and it was buoyant. And, you know, I said, let's grab it. And if we go down the channel, hang on to it. We'll stay with it.
Ooh, wow.
Kangaroos just jumping past me.
You know, you did the right thing, but boy, that must have been frightening.
It was frightening, Steve, but worse was my husband was in the house, my house, it never floods. And it was up to his chin. And one of the neighbours who's got a studio next door, they're the Hussey Hicks, you know, the singers. Mm-hmm. And she come over in a canoe I'd given her, and tied with rope. And she held him up and managed to get him out. Someone arrived in a private boat. So it was pretty tense. But there were people all over Lismore like that. Also Mawoolumbah, they were rescued by the Tinny Army. All our locals went out. Our local SES did, with the few resources they had, totally under-resourced. But we had people were rescued on jet skis, all sorts of things.
Don't be alarmed, folks. This is our Australia Today's program in review. We're looking back at these extraordinary floods that swept through Australia in March in particular. But they weren't over by then. By the way, Janelle, remember we got her back on? She got the canoe that had saved her, and she was going to mount it on the wall when she redoes her house.
But, Steve, what's blown me away by re-listening to those stories is, as it was unfolding, and we're just about to speak about what happened in Yugara a couple of weeks ago when that town in the central west of New South Wales was decimated, is the resilience of these people. Listening to Janelle, she's talking about literally up to her neck in floodwater and trying to paddle out and survive.
Floating on a tyre.
So calm. And the resilience of these people, keep in mind now we're in December, that happened in February, and so many of those residents in Lismore are still without a home and still without a business.
Yeah, we'll hear a bit from Steve Krieg in a moment. But Yugara was particularly close to you because you know that area so well.
Yeah, I grew up in Mudgee and worked at Prime TV in Orange in my early years. It seems like 50 years ago now, but travelled across the central west of New South Wales and often covered all of these really important stories. Yugara is a very small community, but a lot of wonderful people live in that area. And it was absolutely terrifying. When that story first developed, exactly like Lismore, we didn't realise the enormity of it until we started to hear some of the stories. It was on the morning of Monday, November the 14th. Now, yet again, this is the elephant in the room, Steve. The local residents did not get a prediction of a massive flood. They were told there'd been floodwaters upstream and to prepare for possible flooding. But the best descriptions we had was it was an inland tsunami. Without any warning, a wall of water decimated this local town. We had many people.
So like Lismore, Yugara just was sitting there
sitting
unprepared.
Ducks, absolutely. And we noted during our coverage that if this hit early on that Monday morning, if this had been in the middle of the night, there would have been hundreds of people dead. But we had lots of people talking to us about what was happening in Noongarra on that awful morning, including we heard from one of the local residents and local member telling us about what had happened. This is Andrew G. Let's take a listen to what he was telling us about Noongarra.
It's just heartbreaking for Noongarra. That's all you can really say. Words can't really describe the hurt and the pain that's going on in Noongarra at the moment. And it's going to be a long, hard road to recovery. There are stories of great heroism here, I have to say. Community members, young blokes on trucks who are just going around pulling people out of homes with rising flood waters and getting the RFS ladder off the truck and putting them onto the roof and the veranda of the pub. There was one guy who was telling me that he was in his ute. The water, it was a tsunami coming at him, picked up the ute and smashed it into the side of a house. So he was trapped in there, couldn't open the doors. Luckily, he was able to wind down the window of the ute, which was lined up with the window of the house. That's the only way he could get out. So he gets into the house, and in the house are three kids and a mum. So he helps the mum and three kids get into and then onto the roof. And he said just as he hoisted the last child up, the floodwaters were around his neck. Other families just had miraculous escapes. One family were caught in the floodwaters, and there was a trampoline that had kind of floated up next to a house, and they were able to kind of climb onto that and half bounce and half get onto the roof. Like, just crazy stories. And also there's an air of great sadness in Noongarra today because they've lost one of their much-loved residents, and it's hanging very heavy at the moment. And today it's clean up. So I've been in Noongarra over the last few days working with my RFS brigade. And we were originally checking homes, and then once it got into the cleanup phase, we've been basically pumping out and hosing out people's homes. But there is massive devastation. It is Lismore-scale devastation with a smaller community. That's how I would describe it.
Well described. And the stories he told about those people and trying to be rescued is extraordinary.
How terrifying that story about that guy in the ute looking in his rear-vision mirror and seeing a wall of water come towards him. But as we mentioned earlier, after Lismore, there were questions asked about the SES. Now, I'm not having a go at the local crews because they're extraordinary. But what are we doing moving forward about weather warnings and flood warnings with the Bureau of Meteorology? Because they got it terribly wrong both times with devastating consequences. And there's been a lot of criticism of local dams. What are we doing with water conservation, building dams, making sure water management is really important? 7:30 Report did a great investigation after Noongarra, asking serious questions about why those residents weren't given adequate warnings.
Well, I think Steve Krieg summed it up. He said that what we've got to do is use Lismore as an example of what not to do in the future.
Indeed.
And what where not to build, where not to let planning permission be given. Mm. And so mitigation, dams, all of the things you mentioned. This still goes on. I mean, we haven't even got to the Victorian floods. Went through Echuca,
Southeast Queensland.
I mean, the whole country pretty much has been affected. So much so that we went back this week to check on Steve Krieg, the Lismore mayor, because he's been so generous to us on Australia Today all year. Here's what he told us.
I want to say right from the outset, thanks for sticking with us. You're the only broadcaster that has kept this story going for the last, as you say, 9.5 months. And on behalf of our city, I wanted to thank you for sticking with us, because it is a big news story, and it's going to be a news story for the next 4 or 5 years.
That's why we've loved doing Australia Today,
absolutely,
helping out those communities. Natasha Belling, it's been a huge pleasure for me to work with you. Your professionalism, and I'm sure we'll see plenty of you next year. You work 7 days a week, but half the time you've got to just take it a bit easier.
It's a joy working with
you're getting
you.
Getting on,
Steve,
just relax a little bit.
But what an extraordinary year. Now, you're a veteran of 50 years in the media. Have you ever seen a year like we've experienced in 2022?
Probably not. I mean, you can think of the big years that you cover, things like, you know, September 11 or the bushfires of 2019 and all of those major events. But this has been relentless. Every week, every month, there's been a massive story of one sort or another.
We
had a change of government, but you've got a war in Ukraine. You had Donald Trump threatening to come back again. I mean, it's been incredible. And we've lost so many people. I mean, you talk about me being in the media 50 years. It makes me feel old when you consider
that we know all these people.
All these people that I've grown up with forever. I mean, you know, from when I was a baby, the Queen was the Queen.
Of course, we lost Queen Elizabeth, but also this year we lost cricketing legend Shane Warne.
Oh, that was
shocking death.
I still can't believe Warne's dead.
No, I know.
I still think he's going to turn up on the television commentating on the cricket with that cheeky grin on his face.
I know he'd be in heaven, but gosh, they'd have a good party in heaven considering who's up there right now.
Would they ever? Who else?
Olivia Newton-John.
Yeah, that was sad.
An extraordinary, you know, and I think we also, with all the tributes flowing for Olivia Newton-John, she fought an extraordinary battle against breast cancer. But not only was she a much-loved movie star, she was such one of the first famous Aussies in Hollywood. She was a great singer and, of course, from Greece. But she was also a huge campaigner and supporter of groundbreaking research into breast cancer.
Yep.
And she was instrumental in setting up that fantastic cancer centre in Melbourne, where she gave so many other Australians battling cancer the chance to fight.
And Judith Durham. I grew up the Seekers. I mean, I wanted the Double White album from the Beatles, but Mum gave me Seekers Live.
It still triggers you, doesn't it? Does it still
trigger
you? It's the
worst thing I ever saw under a Christmas tree. I told Judith Durham this. I interviewed her a number of times face to face. I said, look, I love you dearly, but I didn't want your record. I wanted the White album.
And did they say that's the end of the interview?
She laughed. You know, she laughed. She had a great sense of humour. So take us through the reaction that happened once Queen Elizabeth passed away on our program. So we go back to Friday, September 9, our time, which I think was the 8th of September in the UK.
And remember, it was just days earlier she'd had actually sworn in the new British Prime Minister, Liz Truss.
Yeah, now, how much can
it was quite extraordinary, but yet again, that last photo we saw of Her Majesty in public, where she was shaking Liz Truss's hand, is yet again instrumental to the fact that she was serving her country and her Commonwealth until the very, very
history
end.
In the making. We've had this year, history in the making.
Absolutely. And we found out it was around 3 a.m. our time on
That's
Friday,
right. I got
September
a text 9. Message at 3 in the morning.
Steve, you're not going to be shocked by this. Mm. I saw that interesting statement that was released a couple of hours beforehand, and I was texting Ange Bishop saying, hang on, does this mean the Queen's death is imminent? And she said yes. So I was watching it unfold on Twitter and social media. So this is how the world found out through the BBC. It was Thursday, September 8 UK time, and this is how the world found out that Queen Elizabeth II, at the age of 96, had passed away.
This is BBC News from London. Buckingham Palace has announced the death of Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. In a statement, the palace said the Queen died peacefully at Balmoral this afternoon. The King and the Queen Consort will remain at Balmoral this evening and will return to London tomorrow.
Makes me teary.
I cried when I found out.
Oh.
And it's just because she has been a constant. I haven't known another
monarch. It's even
more
than that. It's the tradition of Britain.
Yes.
With the voice of the BBC.
Yes.
This is the BBC. I mean, those words, this is the BBC, we're at war.
Yes.
With Hitler. I mean, that's history in the making.
And talking about the war, we also forget what an extraordinary legacy and what she had seen during her lifetime,
Amazing.
Queen Elizabeth II. We know that her father, who was never supposed to be king, stayed in London as it was bombed during World War II. She had seen none of whatever any of us will ever see during our lifetime. And Ange Bishop.
Your great friend. She was there and managed to get her on the program.
She was actually over there for a press junket with George Clooney and Julia Roberts for their new movie.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the news broke. And very kindly I spoke with Ange and said, Ange, you know, her knowledge of the royal family is extraordinary. And this is what she told us on Australia Today of the huge impact and feeling in the UK as they lost their great monarch.
The feeling of emotion as I stand here looking at the balcony that Queen Elizabeth II first stood on when she was, was held, when she was just 1 year old, so 95 years ago, is quite incredible. And the emotional outpouring from the people who have gathered here on what is a very rainy night in London, not too chilly, but certainly the heavens have opened up, perhaps also shedding a tear for the loss of Her Majesty. Flowers are beginning to be laid at the gate, reminiscent of, you know, just over 25 years ago when we lost Diana, Princess of Wales. I've seen some people openly sobbing. I've seen so many faces and accents from around the world. There's people from around the world here. London, of course, always a tourist mecca, and all united in mourning this incredible woman who for 70 years was so constant, so reassuring in this chaotic world full of turmoil, the Queen was always there. And it's an immense sense of loss to be facing a future without her. I think we've known for some time that we were on borrowed time with Her Majesty. We knew she was unwell. She certainly was looking more frail than ever. But as soon as she smiled, as soon as she gave us that smile that we've seen for 70 years, something always made you feel reassured. No, 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 she'll be fine. She'll be fine. And we saw that smile on Tuesday, as you say, just 2 days ago, when she swore in Liz Truss's new British Prime Minister. And so everyone thought, right, she's, you know, she's in Balmoral, she's in a happy place. She didn't travel to London, but that's fine. And so today has been an enormous shock when that message, that very unusual message, came from the palace just after lunchtime, saying she's under medical supervision and she was comfortable. And then we watched as her children and grandchildren made their way to Aberdeen Airport and then got in the car to travel to the castle there. It dawned on us all that, you know, no, this is it. This is going to be it. And it's just been the most dreadful feeling all day. I was talking to cabbies, talking to people in shops, you know, and they're all just, everybody was saying, we're just waiting for news, and that's an awful feeling. And then when it finally came, it was like the city let out a sigh of grief.
The grief of that day was extraordinary. Mm. I mean, and you couldn't get your head around the fact that finally the Queen was no longer with us and it was going to be King Charles III.
And as Ange said, she was the constant for us, especially during the turmoil of the last couple of years. And whether you're a monarchist or not, you have to have great admiration for an extraordinary leader that has lived through extraordinary times.
Special edition of Australia Today, looking back at the world-changing events during the year in 2022. We skip ahead to our great mate, Hugh Whitfeld from Seven, who does such an extraordinary job. We've spoken to Hugh in locations all around the world. Ukraine, he was there. And he was at the funeral on the 20th of September. So this is about 11 days after the Queen passed away. Here's how Hugh described what happened that day.
Look, it was perfect in every sense of the word. Not a step out of time, not a hare or a horse or even a corgi out of place. And I think those corgis, Sandy and Mick, waiting for Her Majesty outside St George's Chapel will go down as one of the pictures of the day, along with George and Charlotte, 9 and 7 years old, second and third in line to the throne, walking behind their great-grandmother's funeral. But this was just dripping in the pageantry and the pomp and the ceremony and the tradition that this country manages to pull off so successfully every single time, with 2,000 in the congregation at Westminster Abbey, including US President Joe Biden and French President Emmanuel Macron and Anthony Albanese and kings and queens and princes and princesses from right across Europe, even the Japanese emperor, the first time that he has attended a funeral for the death of a monarch outside Japan. So just remarkable pageantry and scenery, I guess, for people to look at. And then the personal little touches that Elizabeth was able to add to her plans as well.
And that's, of course, been an ongoing story. And sadly, we've had the Harry and Meghan thing, which when you listen back to the death of the Queen, it makes what they've done, I think, even worse.
Well, it will never be the same, Steve. And I think King Charles has a difficult job in front of him, because I think even with the Queen's funeral, everyone was okay with the expense and the pomp and ceremony, because it was a farewell to not only a monarch, but a farewell to a monarchy that is forever changed.
And we need to thank Hugh, and we spoke to Hugh in the last hour of the program, of course, about your favourite documentary, the latest release of the Harry and Meghan tales. We'll look at some sporting moments later, and we'll also reflect on some of the other issues that have made news during what's been an extraordinary year. But we started the year, of course, in February, Natasha, February of this year, when Ukraine was invaded by the Russians. It's just awful to think what's happened there. We've been joined regularly by Kira Ruddick, the Ukraine MP, who's described it. And we've had the access to some extraordinary reporters, particularly Chris Reason from the Seven Network, Jeff Parry from the Seven Network, Hugh Whitfeld was there, Sarah Greenoch was there as well. It's just changed the way that the whole world is living at the moment because of the energy crisis.
And I know also the focus is on Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, ongoing concerns about his health, and the fact that we're almost this stalemate right now, Steve, where 11 months on? Russia is still invading.
Yeah, February 21 it began.
And still, you know, almost 12 months on, the invasion is still continuing. The Ukrainian people, we know that the Russians have bombed local hospitals, maternity wards, and then, of course, just before Christmas, there was real concerns. We were on the edge of World War III. You would remember when we were on air, there were concerns that a Russian missile had been put into Poland, yes, which, as we know with history, that's what started World War II. Then there was a lot of conflict. Volodymyr Zelensky was adamant it was a Russian missile. Then we realise it maybe possibly might have been a Ukrainian missile that was trying to fend off a Russian attack. And we were all on tenterhooks thinking, if this is an invasion of Poland, that's the beginning of World War III.
So 21 February, it starts, and then 3 days later, the full-scale invasion takes place. That's on the 24th in Europe, 25th here in Australia. And Vladimir Putin made it very clear that he thought they'd be in Kyiv within 3 days. Mm. He thought that this would be done and dusted. The Ukrainians had put their hands up and surrender. How wrong he's been. So what then happens, of course, is Ukraine begins to fight back, and we've heard horrific stories of war crimes, of torture, of people being raped.
Mass graves.
Chris Reason, 3 days after the invasion started, he was in Kyiv. He was in the UK. Remember we had that long chat to him earlier a couple of months ago? He was in the UK doing a separate story, and they sent him straight into Ukraine, which is a very dangerous thing. He described to us what it was like driving in from Poland, how they had to get through all these roadblocks. So we spoke to him on the 28th of February. By this time, Chris Reason from Seven, and thank you, Chris, for all the work you've done for us this year.
Extraordinary.
Chris was in Kyiv. You're in Kyiv. We are seeing reports that it's surrounded. How grim is it there? How tough does it feel to be in that spot?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a fascinating situation, Pricey. I mean, watching Kyiv, it had been the sort of principal target for Vladimir Putin's forces, and they had expected to take it and topple it long before now. It hasn't happened, and this resistance that the Ukrainians have put up has not only shocked the press, myself, the world observers, but I think the Russians as well. They weren't expecting them to be able to hold on this well. They had thought that they would be able to get into the city and take it by now. It hasn't happened. The mayor of Kyiv came out today saying he now knows that the city is completely surrounded, all bridges cut and either destroyed or held, all roads in and out now held by Russians. It'll only be a matter of time. It probably only ever was going to be a matter of time. But look, at the end of the day, the resistance has been something that's just been something amazing to behold. And it's something that's being replicated across every town, village and city in this country. And I think it's something that's caught Putin by surprise. It just hasn't gone the way he'd predicted it would go.
If people want to get out, they can't. That includes you, presumably. So what's going to be the end point here? I mean, is that resistance going to be able to hold the Russians off indefinitely, or at some point are they going to get to the Ukraine president and the parliament and overthrow it that way?
Look, that's the way the game is supposed to work. That's what everyone assumes would happen. But it just doesn't seem to be working like that on the ground. And I thought, like you, that, you know, I'd be trapped and I'd be stuck here and there. And I've sort of refused to go into those high-rise buildings in the CBD. I'm sort of hanging out in the suburbs and moving around a little bit, sort of more low profile, and being able to get out and just, you know, do some filming and doing the sort of stuff that we like to do for 7 years. But it's, you know, we're hoping that we'll still be able to be mobile, and we have been mobile. And there's sort of times in the day when you can pick the time to go out, and there isn't anyone stopping you. Sometimes it's full on fighting. You can hear the gunfire, and you keep your head down. You don't move anywhere. And then the whole concept of the city being stuck and everyone being in there isn't quite accurate. And we've seen, you know, obviously tens of thousands of people flee that city and head mostly westward toward Poland and clog up those roads and the trains getting out, just trying to look for any sort of salvation, sanctuary, and Poland has been providing it extraordinarily so. More about that later. But, mate, the situation of Kyiv is an interesting one to watch. And I'm just not convinced. If someone was saying that Tuesday was going to be the day that it would fold, I'm not so convinced it's going to be that easy a playbook for the Russians. They're having trouble, mate.
How right was Chris Reason?
Absolutely.
And what does that say about putting people on the ground and reporting from where it happened?
Absolutely. And congratulations to Seven also for, you know, of course, there's a humanitarian disaster unfolding, but we all need to be across these international events, Steve. What's continuing to unfold in Ukraine is horrifying. And of course, this year, Volodymyr Zelensky yet again representing to us about courage and tenacity, that he was named Time's Person of the Year.
Man of the Year. Fantastic effort by Volodymyr Zelensky. I mean, I'm just so pleased that we could replay that audio there from Chris Reason, because it takes you back to 3 days in. He's gone, and, well, I don't know that this is playing out the way Putin thinks it's going
to
play out.
It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, because concerningly, Putin has nothing to lose now.
No, he doesn't. I mean, one of the pleasures we've had on Australia Today, this is our last program on air, by the way, we were able to hook into Ukraine MP Kira Ruddick. Now, I can't tell you the number of times I got up at about 4 a.m. to talk to Kira. She insisted on talking to us on Zoom. You've seen her. Mm. She has the Ukraine flag behind her, the flag of the European Union. She ends every chat we have with
glory to you,
glory to Ukraine. You and I have joked and thought, you know, is this woman sitting in a basement somewhere in
Surrey Hills?
Yeah, but no, she went to Brussels.
Incredible.
Where she advocated for Ukraine to join the European Union, mm-hmm. and more importantly, NATO. She went to New York and addressed the United Nations. And we've had the privilege of being able to talk to someone who's actually in the Ukraine Parliament.
On the ground.
And she is such an inspirational person for her. Last time we spoke to her was on Wednesday this week. Mm. But let's go back. This is the 4th of November, Friday the 4th of November, when we spoke to her. Have a listen.
I think the world and political leaders still live under this illusion that there is a possible to figure out some agreement. And personally, I hope they will forfeit this illusion at some point. But politically, we understand that it will take time until all the countries will understand what we have learned a while ago, that it is impossible to get an agreement with Putin. I think the whole world still thinks of Russia as a super mighty country that can do whatever they want. I think we have proved in Ukraine that they are not super mighty, that you can fight them, that you should fight them, and then you will see them step back. And this is something that the whole world needs to understand and take a stance and say, no, we are not sitting at the same table with Putin. This is my hope. And this is why we are proud that President Zelensky said that he's not going to be there if Putin will be there. And I do hope that soon the rest of the world leaders will also take the stand and make Russia what it deserves to be, like a new North Korea, pariah between the countries that nobody wants to shake hands with, because the isolation is the only fast and good way for Russia to collapse and actually to stop the war.
Very strong woman, and she told us just on Wednesday that they're now heading into winter. The town of Odessa, 1.5 million people, no mm-hmm. power. So they're still going to have to get through the cold of winter. And as I pointed out to her, Natasha, that if you look at history, weather conditions like winter, particularly in that part of the world, often decide what the outcome of a war is. So we will keep our fingers crossed for our friend Kira Ruddick.
And I also think this is instrumental in what happens with Vladimir Putin moving forward. There's been allegations he'll be assassinated, he'll have to step down, because this is incredibly, however he wants to spin it, an incredible embarrassment for him.
Yeah, and the Chinese have walked away from him now, so he pretty much is a world pariah. But what it's doing, it's impacting on every part of our lives, because the issue with the Russian gas and oil mm-hmm. means that the prices have spiked in the UK and Europe, and that means that in Australia we're paying more for it, which means we're feeding into our inflation. So
we also should care on a humanitarian front, the fact that these people have been invaded by Russia, and, you know, it's put us all in a very difficult situation.
Let's bring it back home to the election. What was the date of the election? Can you remember?
Oh, I've tried to forget so much that has happened.
May 21, 2022. Seems like years ago. How long ago does it seem that we had Scott Morrison as Prime Minister?
A decade ago.
I know. Anthony Albanese wins and he goes straight onto a plane.
Yes.
Remember, and flew to Japan for mm-hmm. the Quad meeting. Everyone thought, boy, that's getting into the job pretty quickly. There's only two of them in charge for a couple of days. This was a little bit of his victory speech on that Saturday night.
Tonight, the Australian people have voted for change. I am humbled by this victory, and I'm honoured to be given the opportunity to serve as the 31st Prime Minister of Australia. My Labor team will work every day to bring Australians together, and I will lead a government worthy of the people of Australia. A government as courageous and hardworking and caring as the Australian people are themselves. My fellow Australians, it says a lot about our great country that the son of a single mum who was a disability pensioner, who grew up in public housing down the road in Camperdown, can stand before you tonight as Australia's Prime Minister.
It was very Labor speech. It was very Whitlam-esque, actually. I mean, they'd been in opposition, we've got to remember, since 2007. So it must be sweet when you win an election like that.
Yet I do think there was an element of the lesser of the two evils, which we've seen of a failure of both sides of politics for a number of years. I spoke to you earlier this year. I always stay in the election line and listen to what people are saying. Every single year, I'd say for at least the last three or four elections, all I've heard people say, I don't know who to vote for. I don't like either, and I'm not inspired by either leader and their policies or vision for the country moving forward.
7 months in, I think Scott Morrison's reputation's been shredded.
Tatters.
And I think the research the Labor Party had done in the lead up to this election clearly was this: the people who vote him out, they're not necessarily voting us
in.
But they're gonna vote him out because they don't like Scott Morrison. He'd run his race, and I think his arrogance has been shown to be over the top, and I think his colleagues have turned on him. And when he did the old trick of I'm going to be the minister for everything and didn't tell anyone, including Josh Frydenberg, I think that cooked his goose within the Liberal Party. Let's get on to much more generous and wonderful and exciting things. I know you're such a sports nut and you just love your contact sport and you love playing your touch footy. What was your highlight of the sporting year, do you reckon?
It has to be Ash Barty, Steve. I think all of us, she played
doing
in the Australian
what?
Open, winning the Australian Open.
I'd forgotten how long ago
was
that?
I know, it was on the 29th of January this year. It seems like a lifetime ago. And, of course, she recorded a thrilling victory over American Danielle Collins in the championship at Rod Laver Arena. The whole nation was behind her. I think she found a lot of pressure. But what was extraordinary is what I love about Ash is she's incredibly gracious, she's tenacious, and that she then, just 8 weeks later after winning the Australian Open, made this announcement that shocked everyone.
And I just knew that for me, the time was right. I'd given absolutely everything that I could to this sport. And I knew that it wouldn't be fair to my team and the people that have invested so much time and energy into my life to not be 100% committed for them. So it's been a hell of a journey. I wouldn't change a thing. And I certainly have no regrets.
Remember the story that emerged that she'd actually thought about retiring before that?
That's
and
right.
Then decided, okay, no, well, I want to win the Australian Open. I want to win my home event, my home Grand Slam. And then she went out and managed to do that.
At the top of her game, retiring at the top of her game. And she revealed actually part of the reason that she decided to walk away when she was at her very best is she said that the pressure and media attention attached to competing at sport's highest levels had become disproportionate to the enjoyment of her playing the game. What I love about her is you can achieve anything. Hard work. She's gracious and she's incredibly kind.
Why don't she make a comeback? Well, I'd rather her still play.
Because that says everything about her. She's not there for the money or the accolades. She's there because she loves playing sport and she walked away at the top of a game.
And she said at some point that the pressure was just too much. I didn't want to have that pressure. I'm going to do something else. So she goes out and plays golf where she plays off a zero handicap.
Does that upset
you? That's
too
unfair.
Does that upset you?
It upsets me greatly. But she's not going to be there during this Australian Open, which is going to be pretty sad because she was number one in the world.
That's okay. I'm okay with that. She's walked away at the top of a game and she's shown what true sports stars should do, not be kind of ruled by fame and fortune because you love the game. And your mate, of course, the other big sporting highlight was Cam Smith with the extraordinary mullet.
Yeah, and that takes us to a completely different place because he has walked away from the PGA to take money with the LIV golf, but he won the British Open, which is an extraordinary event for an Australian to win. Here's what he said after that victory.
Had a lot of support out there, especially the Aussie guys. You guys really kept me going out there. Seemed like there was a lot of you guys out there, kept me plugging away, and this one's for Oz. Thanks, guys.
Well, Cam's back in the country. He is playing tournaments through the Australian summer, but this whole live PGA thing has to sort itself out. A great year it was. It's been a great year for you and I think. Natasha, that's it for Australia Today in 2022. That's it for Australia Today. We're not back in 2023. It's been a great delight to work with you for the past 2 years. You are a true professional, and your appetite for news and your obsession with COVID has been something to behold. So good luck with whatever you and the team are up doing next.
Thank you for all your support, Steve.
My pleasure. Good on you and goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this Australia Today podcast. For more of the news that affects you, download the Listener app and search Australia Today. Listener.